Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, zip up your leather pants, slap on the clown paint, and don't forget to eat something light as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
Testing 1, 2. There we go.
Check 1, 2.
I can up the volume.
Can you auto tune Andy's part?
Do you just want to jump into it?
You can.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about anomalies, legends, and monsters. We are broadcasting on location at Monster Bash 2019 in Mars, PA.
Live from the surface of Mars.
Yeah. Mars, of course, home to a statue that Andy has never seen of a UFO.
Never seen it. Yeah. I don't think it's real.
I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined, as always, by my pal.
That's me, Mark Matzke. And, as was aforementioned, Andy's with us today.
Hi.
Some of you may remember young Andy Matzke.
Andy's insistent no one remembers. No. So, yeah, do we want to do some sort of... what is Monster Bash, Mark?
Oh, Monster Bash is a film convention that centers on classic movie monsters of the 30s through, say, the 70s and 80s. Think Universal Monsters, think Lugosi, Karloff, Vincent Price.
If they're a movie from the 90s, we hate them. No 90s.
Well, that's not to say... That
they're
going
about to argue semantics. So,
and they've had, you know, as far as guests are concerned, they've had people who have worked in the films with some of the greats. They've had some of the actors and actresses who are actually in the films, such as Julie Adams. Until recently, she had been here a couple times, and she's since passed away. Julie Adams from Creature from the Black Lagoon, Rico Browning, who is in the creature suit for the underwater scenes, is here as a guest. And
not to interrupt, do all the frills on your jeans serve a purpose?
No.
No?
They're just there.
Okay. I got distracted. I got distracted.
There's not like, they're not like pockets.
Okay,
right?
I didn't know.
The design.
Julie Adams.
They an increased drag.
Oh,
actually,
yeah.
If he starts moving
faster.
Too, yeah.
Oh, so you can run slower.
Yeah, it slows him down.
Yeah, sort of. They're like a parachute. Yeah.
That way, I can't run away.
But they've had, say, Vincent Price's daughter, Victoria. They've had Lon Chaney Jr.'s son. Just stuff like that. People connected to these films and. Sort of other ancillary
characters.
Interests and characters, yes.
Yeah.
Like our buddy Stan Gordon, because of his interest in this genre, it has been, I think, I don't know how long he's been doing it, but ever since we've been coming to this conference, which is, I think we're in year 7, he's done a report about Chestnut Ridge and Pennsylvania mysteries.
And this is a fitting place to record this episode, because I think today we're talking about Toho cryptozoology / ufology, possible influences on the movies, and then probably talk about the latest movie and a little bit about Godzilla.
Yeah.
Godzilla. Like, I get really sad talking about Godzilla. Godzilla just in general. And if the sound quality is not up to par, It's just because we're recording on location. We have one Yeti mic, and we're kind of sandwiched behind the STM table against a wall.
We're hiding from everyone.
Yeah, we're hiding from mankind. So if the audio is not up to its usual standards, for instance, if you don't have a loud freaking clock that Main Street Wadsworth is fighting me on. By the way, thank you to Wadsworth's Community Radio 97.1 FM for having us on the air, Monsteropolis. So yeah, Monster Bash. I highly recommend this event, and we kind of play it year by year. We did it. This is our second year of doing it, so I'm not sure we'll be here next year or not. Just because events, we never know like what's going to happen. But I recommend it regardless. Like I'd probably come check it out just as a fan, regardless, because it's got all the classic monster movie stuff that I love. And it's like a fitting place too. I was gonna try to have Momo posted the drive-in posters for this because this is like the perfect event for something like that. But yeah, so Toho. So I tweeted at Mike Dougherty, the director of Godzilla King of the Monsters, and he never tweeted back. But I tweeted at him to ask him if ufology or cryptozoology played a part in like the mythology building for the movie for King of the Monsters, because it seems much more steeped in, at least to me, I don't know, you guys probably know this stuff better than I do because I haven't seen all the original Godzilla movies, but to my mind when I was watching it, I thought it seemed more steeped in like that kind of thing. Like I could see some direct influence of like even like Lauren Coleman and things like that on the movie. And I'm aware of the fact that like Adam is involved in the behind the scenes stuff for this, and Adam's really into cryptozoology and the paranormal, and he's aware of Kiel and all that stuff. So I'm wondering how much of that is playing into the mythology building of the movies.
I think
lean in
with this.
Okay, so yeah, what the question was about. Cryptozoology and ufology play a role in the movie.
I think with this latest Godzilla King of the Monsters, there's much more of a basis in mythology and like quote unquote like real mythology and things like that that are based off actual events than in previous Godzilla films. There's more like this is what the legend was. I mean, that's always been a part of it, but that's sort of how the explanation
so,
for every type.
How much of that has to do with the fact that it's American-made versus Japanese, which is going to be much more rooted in their mythology, which is makes sense given what the characters look like and stuff like that, but there's going to be more of an Americanized spin on it, which would probably bring in the cryptozoology and paranormal, like ufology, like background, backstory.
Yeah, and that kind of forms the backbone of the legendary so-called Monsterverse. You know, you have the Monarch organization, and they're tasked with, being cryptozoological about finding and identifying the creatures.
Well, it's almost like Men in Black meets, I don't know.
In King of the Monsters, for example, you even have a Dr. Coleman who's part of the team. And that all seems to be pretty, one Easter egg of many in the whole movie about sort of the general direction of where the story is going. And another thing, too, this isn't unique necessarily to the American movies, but the whole idea of being able to control the monster using technology is sort of a Western concept, because in the originals there was no controlling Godzilla, he was just rampaging. But now you've got the whole idea, with the Orca device, you can sort of make the monsters do what you want. That's very 21st century America. If you have the right technology, you can make these things do what you want.
Well, I think sort of comparing this one to the Japanese Godzilla movies, with the exception of one Japanese movie, it's mostly just Godzilla is a result of the atomic testing. There's sort of more of that side to it. Sure, there's other kaiju, giant monsters that have sort of like a mythological origin, but with the exception of the with giant monsters all out attack, they're not like any mythological origin to them. But with this King of the Monsters, there's sort of that mythological sort of cryptozoological angle to them, that they've always been here and that there's like tales of them.
Well, in the original, the 54 Godzilla.
Good lord.
It starts on Odo Island, and there are sort of rituals that they do that acknowledge that they know Godzilla exists. And so that's, in a way, that's lifted and placed into the latest film. But nothing is really made of that fact. I mean, that passes by very quickly in the original. And you get the impression that nobody really expects to see the creature at the heart of the rituals emerge. So there is a sense of surprise when Godzilla does actually appear on the island. But, I mean, the type of fan that I am, the novelization of the recent film, each chapter does begin with sort of a fictionalized style quote of some ancient literature that helps support a belief, let's say, one is the Thunderbird, giant moth, I mean, just going right on down the line. So it is consciously tying into a sense of, in the folklore, there are buried these stories of giant monsters, which is what cryptozoology kind of is.
Can you introduce yourselves as Godzilla fans? Because I don't think we've really talked about it on the show before. Because like, you guys are uniquely suited to talk about Godzilla.
Well, we used to do a podcast about like giant Japanese monsters. And if you want to hear my voice an octave higher, go check out Monsterland Ohio Radio. But we've been involved with G-Fest, which is a Godzilla convention in Chicago, for many years, and we've had the opportunity to meet many people involved with these movies.
Yeah, I mean, right, and
you guys were bragging yesterday that you're your best friends with the director of Shin Godzilla. Best friends, Andy.
Those were
the words Andy used.
I said we had other director friends.
Yeah, I would stop short of saying best friends, but we have gotten Chicago-style hot dogs with Shinji Higuchi, the director of Shin Godzilla.
Yeah.
And his wife really took a shine to the little Andy of, 8-9 years ago?
Yeah, that would explain it.
Right. But, I mean, I've had an intense interest in Godzilla ever since I was a little kid. Those movies were on TV a lot where I started getting interested about that, which is the Detroit, Michigan area. And actually, Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla and Godzilla on Monster Island were playing in theaters when I was a kid, along with Star Wars, all in 1977 and 78. That was like a in-theater experience that I was having. So that plus Ultraman being on TV in suburban Detroit, that was my, the beginning of my interest in Godzilla. And then I was fortunate enough to grow up in an area of Michigan, not urban per se, but one of the independent studios or independent stations in town would have a Godzilla week at least once a year, sometimes twice, where it was every day when you got home from school, like 3 or 4 o'clock, there was a different Godzilla movie on. So like Monday through Friday, you could bank on a new Godzilla movie being shown. And I would look forward to that. And so it's like everything else in my childhood. If I was interested in it, I was obsessed with it and would just get as much information as possible. I really left Godzilla alone for a long time, but then after Andy was born, Sci-Fi Channel showed Godzilla, Mothra, King Ghidorah, Giant Monsters All Out Attack, and I DVR'd it because I had sort of actually lost touch with the idea that they were still producing Godzilla films in Japan. And I watched that and I was just completely blown away. I was not expecting that at all, and not the quality of it. And so we sort of, that was sort of a backwards route into discovering the Godzilla fan community and G-Fest, which is this annual conference of Godzilla fans that takes place in the Chicago area every year. And so, like Andy said, we've been involved with that in various capacities ever since. Most recently, we do sort of the children's art and crafts room and give them things to do. But we've even organized like panel threads for kids and gotten various people involved with doing little presentations or doing like how to draw Godzilla. We've had Godzilla artists involved with that.
And you've been on panels, and I've been on panels there, like in front of people. Not just talking in private, but like I've been on a panel with talking about Marvel comic monsters with Tony Isabella, the creator of Black Lightning, and that was a lot of fun. Like, it's given us a lot of interesting opportunities. So it's always something that's been there. Like, you raised me on these Godzilla movies and monster movies. I've had that realization this week, realizing that these monster movies are sort of what were my Disney movies growing up. And like, that's what I watched when I was little. And so like, I've sort of always had these movies around.
So getting back into the movies, the thing that struck me is the watching the transition between Godzilla 2014, which is very much like what if Godzilla was in the real world,
mm-hmm.
into Skull Island, which starts to push that real world idea away, which is funny because it's actually a step back in time. Like, if it was chronological, it might make a certain sense that the world would be adapting. But that movie steps back in time, and to me, the real world idea kind of goes out the window because those characters in that movie feel like caricatures to me. I don't know that we've ever really talked about Skull Island, too. I'm not crazy about it,
mm-hmm.
which is weird because I adore Kong, and I love like Peter Jackson's King Kong.
Yeah.
I love every incarnation of King Kong that I've seen. I grew up on the original, the Fay Wray. And but Skull Island, I love the monster fights or whatever, but mm-hmm. I didn't care about any of the human characters, and there's one character in there that almost ruins the movie for me. It's what's his name? The crazy World War II veteran guy that shows up.
John C. Reilly character. Yeah.
I can't. He almost ruins the movie for me. But but there's a transition from like real world to Skull Island into what King of the Monsters is that doesn't feel. It doesn't feel natural. It feels like a boardroom of guys came up with an idea and then are frantically trying to stay on target with what their perception of like box office success is going to
mm-hmm.
mean. You know, like, so the good thing is I think I have a lot of faith in Dougherty because I really do love his Krampus movie, but the change in like styles from those three is really interesting to me. Watching Godzilla the 2014 and seeing where the universe is now with King of the Monsters, do you get the idea that was not in place, like the ufological cryptozoological influence that was not in place, that came in later with like Vaught Roberts and Dougherty rather than being in place with Evans in the beginning?
I think that's a very like interesting way to look at it. I actually don't know. I think it would be more of a thing you can tell they came up with a little later, but I think what's like interesting to note is the characters you follow in Godzilla the 2014 one are different from the characters you follow in King of the Monsters, because people in King of the Monsters are already in Monarch, already know all of this, but in the 2014 one you follow people who are from the outside, sort of falling into it.
Yeah,
you're not following like
scientists,
you're following like Bryan Cranston's character is obsessed with it, but he's not like in Monarch, he's sort of outside. So you're not in the Monarch organization except for a few scenes where Dr. Serizawa is like explaining what Godzilla is, or like what we think, what they think it is. So I think it could have been there. It just wouldn't have made much sense to just sort of be thrown in there in that movie, because it is more of a, this is what would happen in the real world. But that mythology certainly could have been in the back of the creator's heads. But I don't know. Yeah, but it is an interesting move, how you were talking about how it like takes a step back in time, but they know more, seemingly.
Yeah, the seeds are there for the Monarch angle. In particular, in the opening and the end credits, there's all this sort
of... Yeah, 2014.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so they don't push that.
I'm talking
nearly.
More about tonal. It feels the like tones there's, are there's weird a very stark tonal difference, mm-hmm. which makes sense because they're all different directors, but
right.
to me it almost feels...
If you go from...
A little haphazard.
Godzilla to King of the Monsters, it's totally different. But yeah. I think it works, because if you would have had the same tone... For King of the Monsters, I think it would have felt as... I think something that's very important to note is how much they played to the fans in King of the Monsters.
Yeah.
And that's something I don't know if I like about the movie. Like, I love the movie, but I can't, like, take my friends to go see it because they won't appreciate it as much as I will. And, like, that's fine. They weren't raised on these movies. But, like, the fact that Millie Bobby Brown's character says Monster Zero is, like, such an awesome moment for me, but, like, I know, like... The reference, and if you don't, that's fine. There's no problem with that. But the amount that they played to the fans is so large that if they would have kept that real tone, it would have, like, you would have almost felt cheated in a way, I want to say. But I don't know. I really don't know.
Well, it's reflective of the Godzilla series in total. And by that I mean there's never been an even tone to Godzilla, because you've had multiple directors in Japan working on it across decades, and it's meant different things at different times. I mean, the 54 original is a horror sci-fi nightmare, and by the 70s, Godzilla's the Earth Defender, and these movies are for kids. So they're all over the map historically. So the shift isn't as pronounced between, let's say, 14 and 19. But even so, part of the problem is typically in a Godzilla film, he's going to be either the defender of the Earth without any explanation, really. It's just he's the good guy and other monsters are the bad guys, or he's the nightmare and the world is in great danger. But there's always been an ambiguity with the Godzilla character itself, and in this movie, there's hints of that. I mean, he's the clear hero all throughout, except you get to the end, and then, you know, there's the one character who has the line, good thing he's on our side, and somebody says, well, for now.
Which is a hint toward what's going to happen with Kong.
Yeah,
Godzilla.
Right.
I don't know if you guys know this. I know the entire plot of Kong versus Godzilla. So, trying to steer it back a little bit to like cryptozoology and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You said, and I didn't hear this, but you said that Lauren Coleman actually has some involvement in.
Yes, and he's put this out. He said this at the conference. And at that point, he was sort of asking that it be kept under his hat. But since then, I've seen him put it out on social media.
Oh, okay.
So I am assuming it's all right. To talk about the fact that he's filmed a behind-the-scenes documentary special feature for the Blu-ray release of King of the Monsters, in which he's going to talk pretty explicitly, I think, about cryptozoology and how it forms a backbone to this film. And you know, the Coleman character in the film is allegedly a clear tip of the cap to him, which now really makes sense since he's acknowledged an involvement with the development of the film,
so
at least to some degree.
The true story, when you go into the Kong versus Godzilla production offices and you go into Adam's director's suite, the Appalachian Monsters box set is sitting on the Small Town Monsters Appalachian box set.
That's wild.
Like on his TV stand next to, and there's other STM stuff in there. When I was in there, there was a lot of like Nazis and the occult and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
like in there too. But keep that in mind. Dougherty actually follows SDM on Twitter. We're one of only, he doesn't follow many accounts. Mm-hmm. We're one of like a couple hundred, few hundred.
That's
that
wild.
Follows. So I think, I asked the question kind of knowing the answer of him just to see if he would tweet back, and he never did. But like, I was just curious how much of an influence it's playing on him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I already know from Adam's side of things, like how much of an influence, like that cryptozoology, known paranormal stuff. Like, I was going to address some plot points that I can't. There's some things that happen in King of the Monsters regarding the underwater, the temple and all that stuff that they find, the cities and all that. That'll be pushed further, I think, down the road. And a lot of that is rooted in, like, Atlantean, Nazis and the occult, and, like, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So there are very obvious Easter eggs for, like, fans of esoteric topics in the movies. What did you guys think of King of the Monsters?
I loved it. I cried, like, 3 times because I'm such a Godzilla fan watching that movie. Because what I loved about it the most was a very small part of the movie, but the score of the movie has some of the original sound cues, like the original Godzilla themes in the movie, which was not something that they had for the 2014 movie. So to like see Godzilla on the big screen so majestically then with that soundtrack was amazing as like a Godzilla fan. And I think it's probably one of my favorites to date. I enjoyed the tone of it because it was like a not too distant future, I think is what they were going for. That's what I felt they were going for, like sort of like slightly futuristic, which is kind of like a Godzilla movie Toho type thing. But to see it like in theaters when it came out was just such, it was such like a dream come true. It really was like seeing my childhood imagination on screen a couple times, which I've never had happen. So like to see that was amazing.
Yeah, I second what Andy said, but I really took the film, my takeaway of it, comparison that I would make is that it reminds me a lot of the late 60s Showa era Godzilla movies with an unlimited budget. Because it's the Showa era where you get into bringing the monsters together for giant battles. You have, you know, in some respects, it reminds me very much of Destroy All Monsters, which that is the basic plot, as you get as many monsters in one place, and then they all brawl. And the idea that there's a human organization that's studying them and, you know, marking differences and similarities, that's very 1960s Toho. So that was pretty satisfying as far as, and the stuff that Andy said about the music, I mean, you know, you and I have talked about music in the trailers and stuff, and they totally fixed that as far as I was concerned, because they brought in themes from the original series for Mothra, for Godzilla, obviously. And there is an emotional impact that has for long-term fans, because that's the music that you've heard all along associated with these characters. And so when you hear that in a modern movie theater with all the sound capabilities and so forth, it's really very, very powerful. So I enjoyed the experience. I would go see it again today if the opportunity presented itself. I've seen other Godzilla fans online kind of call, I mean, there's always going to be reactions all over the place, but I heard a lot of people say this is the best Godzilla movie ever, and I would debate that really pretty seriously. But
for those listening, Mark's face, it took on a totally sort of
started
very serious.
I mean, but it's one review of the movie that I saw said that this movie tells you an awful lot more about modern America than anything else. And I won't get into all the details of that, but I think that's pretty good. It's, you know, Godzilla filtered through an American sensibility, which is just always going to be a different Godzilla than a Japanese Godzilla. It just is. I mean, but it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
My mom rented us Kong versus Godzilla. That was the first King Kong versus Godzilla, mm-hmm. Godzilla versus King Kong, whatever it's called, when I was a kid. And it's the one that has the scenes with... it's like there's scenes of American actors like cut into,
yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
cut. So it's real awkward. And weird.
It is.
But I remember loving it. It was around that same time where she was getting me into like Harryhausen and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually my introduction to Godzilla, was through that Kong.
Yeah.
Because I loved Kong,
yeah.
So she showed me that. And then years later, Ethan and I did watch Godzilla, the original, and... there's a few others. Like, I think we watched Mothra and a few others. But I'm not... In no way do I claim to be, like, some sort of ardent defender or mm-hmm. lover of Godzilla. Like, I just never... I didn't grow up on it. But I did like... I really liked the 2014... We had you on Ancillary Characters.
Right. Yep.
When the original Godzilla came out and we talked about it. And I really liked it. Skull Island, I thought, was okay. It lost a lot of, like, what I love about Kong, which has always been the heart. Maybe that's why I like Peter Jackson's Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a schmaltzy,
yeah.
You know, schmaltz factory. and so, like... So
but really, that movie really was a love letter to Kong.
Yeah.
And that's what it was.
Yeah.
So I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I adore that movie. Yeah.
But yeah, Skull Island, there's no attachment to...
No, I dislike everyone.
Yeah.
I dislike everyone in the movie to the point where, and I'm not usually the type that's like, I'll go watch slasher movies and find characters like,
mm-hmm.
you know, and usually those are terribly unlikable characters.
Yeah.
Like rooting for people to die.
Yeah, he saves Brie Larson, but he's not in love with Brie Larson.
No.
And that's really weird.
Yeah.
Because typically you see Kong loves the leading
yeah.
lady.
Yeah.
And he's really indifferent to her in
yeah,
this
just,
film.
But you did, the one thing is, like, you do connect with Kong, like, I definitely connected with Kong, you want him to be okay, and all that stuff, so.
So I have this weird theory that when he sees Loki and Brie Larson and together, and they show this close-up of his eyes, to me, I think he sees those two, and he's sympathetic towards them, and I think it reminds him of his parents.
Mm.
That's I'm just making that up,
yeah.
But that's what it struck me as.
Okay.
And so he sees her in a different light than the original Kong sees Fay Wray.
And I wasn't, yeah, Skull Island, I wasn't looking for a remake of King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
I was excited about the idea of expanding the mythology of Skull Island. And I think they did a decent job of it. It's just, on the whole, I'm not, I didn't leave. So the problem is, I think Pacific Rim, in a lot of ways, ruined me for,
mm-hmm.
for most... You know, like giant monster movies going forward, and maybe that was my problem with Godzilla too, with King of the Monsters, because like I went into it expecting that like, and this is probably more about the director, about Pacific Rim's director versus
mm-hmm.
Dockery. It's probably more about that than anything, but. I came into King of the Monsters expecting that same sense of like grandeur and stuff that were conjured through those trailers that you didn't like but I loved,
mm-hmm.
and that was not at all the movie. So maybe that's my problem. I will say I saw it with my wife; she loved it. So maybe when I go back and rewatch it, I won't have the issues that I had with it. And I wouldn't even say I had issues. I just didn't. I didn't get like. There's nothing that really got me emotionally excited or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't like comparing it to Pacific Rim, where that opening scene. I remember. I always think of that opening scene of Pacific Rim, where the monster, where the robot actually comes up out of the ocean and falls on the ground. The scale of that
mm-hmm.
was so massive, and I never got that same sense of scale of this movie. There were two times where I thought it worked. There was when they first touched down in Boston. And you're seeing everything from their point of view on the ground, where
yeah.
I was like, yeah, there's, like,
yeah.
that's what I was kind of, like,
right.
for. But,
Yeah, Pacific Rim is an incredible achievement.
Yeah.
I mean, that, out of any modern giant monster movie, I'd probably want to watch that first. Like, I would watch that any day if Andy said, hey, let's watch Pacific Rim. I'd say, yeah, let's go. Because it builds that world so quickly and so fully. It's just amazing. I love it.
I'm going to go back and talk about Skull Island for 2 seconds because we just recently rewatched this.
Yeah.
And what I think is weird about it is it's not a remake of Kong, but you're taking this beloved character. Because, like, I love the original and I love Peter Jackson's remake. But it's, they take Kong and they sort of bend the character to what the needs of the story is. It's more of like, let's add this story and then we'll add some Kong elements, because they have elements like a wall, but it's like it's keeping things out now, and I don't know if I like that about the movie. I mean, I love the movie,
keeping but
like,
things in,
like it's right? keeping things, it's keeping things out, it's keeping the skull crawlers out in the new one. So like the idea that like they take elements like that and sort of like bend it a little, I don't know if I like about it. It's almost like they should have not done any of that at all, and it just sort of been a Kong in name only thing. But they did then have like those little things in there, and I don't know, that sort of like rubbed me the wrong way about it.
To me, Skull Island is like a B movie on steroids. And maybe that's part of the tonal shift as well, is that 2014, the legendary Godzilla, that doesn't feel like that way to me at all. Skull Island feels like a Bird Eye Gordon movie.
Yeah, I think that's what I like about it. Budget. That's
one thing I can say about all three of them is like they are the anti-Marvel, because Marvel are cookie cutter BS. I'm sorry. It's like, I'm sure that half our listening audience adores these Marvel.
I agree.
But like, I just feel like it's the same movie repeated over and over. Like stylistically, the look of it, like everything. And the best thing about these three, the legendary, like Godzillaverse movies so far, is they are all very much the voice of their director, and I know that that is really daunting for the directors, and I know that from behind the scenes, like what goes on, those the guys that are making those movies are forcing their vision out there. That is what people are seeing, because of the fact that the studio is allowing. They're allowing it to a certain extent, but the directors are fighting to get what they want done. So I think it's really cool that even though I might not adore these movies yet, I think each one is really very much like their director's voice, and they look, they all have a really unique look. Like I'm not crazy about how dark a lot of Godzilla King of the Monsters is, but I love the color play, like the color work in that movie's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Like there's no matter what, like all three of them look so distinctly unique, but they still can exist in that same universe. So I love the way they're
yeah. With these movies, you're definitely watching three different people tell a story about giant monsters, as opposed to the cookie cutter blockbusters that are out there these days. That with these, it's, you can go and watch all of them and get something different out of them than besides, oh man, that was a great movie. You can like get a little something out of it.
And they're Skull Island's cut. I mean, Skull Island stands out because it is, that is a Vaught Roberts movie. Mm-hmm. Like it is so specifically his style, and like the quick cuts and all that stuff. Like everything is just him. But that's not something that you see at like Marvel. Again, like I just going back to Marvel, you don't see that at Marvel. The movies all look the same. They're all cut the same. Mm-hmm. You know, unless you're talking about like Guardians of the Galaxy or Winter Soldier. Like they all are the same movie repeated over and over.
Well, you can tell Doherty loves Godzilla, and he grew up with the Toho universe as sort of his playground, because just the way that the movie is. And I guess that's why I really love the movie. I'm really fond of it, because it is made by a fan. It's like made by a fan for other fans. And if other people like it, that's cool too. But there's so many touches in it.
There's so many. And like,
see, I think there's actually a big influence from, this is almost going to sound, there's a big influence from the initial Godzilla trailer, King of the Monsters trailer, on Terror in the Sky.
Oh, wow.
Because, like, yeah. Because, like, I had just seen that around the time where we were going into making this. And I loved that idea of, like, really pushing that more, like, whatever you want to call it, rather than just, like, scary monster movie.
Yeah.
Sorry, Andy, what were you saying? Okay, in closing, King of the Monsters, best movie ever. Here's the thing. I'm not downplaying the movie at all, because I think I'm really excited about what they're doing with Godzilla. And I actually loved Godzilla 2014. I don't know if I said that. I think I kind of downplayed that one, too. But I actually loved Godzilla 2014, and I've watched that since. And I've watched his first movie, Monsters, which I also really like. Skull Island just for whatever reason didn't connect with me the first time I saw it, but I've seen it multiple times since, and every time I see it I like it a little bit more. So the same thing's probably going to happen when I sit down and watch, especially if King of the Monsters really is doing more setup for what's about to come. Like, if I sit down and I watch it within the context of the rest of the movie. So having said that, King of the Monsters didn't do great at the box office, so, like, who knows how that will affect the franchise moving forward. But I also feel like it's a shame that it didn't do better. Like, I didn't love it, but I really wanted to do well, because, like I said, there's something, I don't know if it's just that I make movies, but I love the fact that it at least is stylistically its own thing. Like, each one is their own thing. And I hate the idea that that would fail somehow, and then all you're going to be left with is a billion Spider-Mans and Iron Mans and Avengers.
if this is what it's setting up, if this is like the beginning of something, I will be happy with these movies, with the rest of them. Because, like, I love the word, like, the, I love Monarch. Like, the way they're out there looking for monsters and they have these giant monsters. Like, that's so cool to me. And I don't think that'll ever stop being cool to me. So, as long as they're making movies similar to this, I will go see them for sure.
To close the circle on the cryptozoology connection, we probably wouldn't have modern cryptozoology as we know it if it were not for Toho Monsters. And the reason I say that is because, by Lauren Coleman's own admission, it was him seeing a Toho movie by the name of Half Human that was made the year after the original Godzilla, so 1955. He saw that on his local television station. The next day he went to school and asked his teacher, "What is this about the abominable snowman?" And the teacher told him, "Forget it, there's nothing to that." And he wasn't satisfied with that answer, so he started looking elsewhere for information, like his local library and so forth, and he's gone on record as saying that it was the one thing above everything else was seeing Toho's Half Human that inspired him to start learning about the Yeti and hidden animals. So this whole sort of burgeoning interest in cryptozoology probably wouldn't exist if it weren't for directors like, you know, Ishiro Honda and Toho Studios in general. So it's really very satisfying to see how that is now paying off in terms of Toho Monsters being pretty well known on an international scale.
If you like the show, leave us a rating and review on iTunes, Google Play, blah blah blah. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, not yet,
no
Instagram. Shoot us an email, monsteropolismail@gmail.com. July 19th, Mark and I are at the Black Forge Coffee House talking live. So if you enjoy the show and you want to hear us do pretty much what we're doing right now, actually, in a live setting without other people talking, you'll be able to check us out there. So Black Forge Coffee House, Pittsburgh, PA, July 19th. Tickets $5 to $10. All ages friendly. I'll keep Mark under control.
Try to.
All right. We'll be back with more.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.